For those of you that haven't recently responded to 2,500 new RIAA allegations of copyright infringement, an exciting session on enforcing copyright in campus networks, lessons learned and next steps. Let me remind you that evaluations are extremely important to EDUCAUSE in planning future events and responses to this. You can get a complete online evaluation from this session either from a link at an email kiosk or on the conference page at this particular session for another couple of weeks. Overall evaluation of the conference, you'll get a solicitation via email in the next couple of weeks. So much for the formalities, aside from reminding you that none of the people here has been known to bite, and we've all brushed our teeth recently, so do feel free to move towards the front of the room. It is my very, very distinct pleasure to introduce this particular panel. Steve Worona has been such an enormous resource for us in so many ways. Aside from his earlier role in founding the Cornell Institute, Internet Policy and Law?
Computer Policy and Law.
And we have a meeting of that group this afternoon. Right after this session. You can follow me as I follow him to it. He currently does the EDUCAUSE Live broadcasts. If you're unfamiliar with those things, they're fantastic. And his official title is Director of Policy and Network Programs at EDUCAUSE. He'll be followed by Ken Flieger from Pomona College, where he is he's CIO and Executive Director of Information Services. We actually span a fair range here in having a representative of a very distinguished, relatively small, liberal arts-oriented college, and then going all the other way to UCLA, where Kent Wada is Director of Strategic IT and Privacy Policy. I'll skip the rest of the introductions because I'm very eager to hear this. Steve?
Thank you, Stephen. I am Steve Worona from EDUCAUSE, and I have been dealing with some of the repercussions of the congressional interest in the use of campus networks for infringement, that interest culminating a while ago in some provisions of the Higher Education Act, which has required all of our campuses to do things beginning last July, and that's what we're going to be spending most of our time talking about. And I want to thank, before I start, Kent and Ken for being willing to stand up here and potentially take the slings and arrows. I asked them to speak as role models. One of the things that EDUCAUSE has done, quite literally, if you go to the www.educause.edu/HEOA for Higher Education Opportunity Act, HEOA webpage, you will find a link to another page that is the role models page, in which we have a dozen or so campuses around the country who've been willing to fill out a template indicating all of the things that they were doing to comply with the Higher Education Act, making the point that Congress did give us a great deal of latitude, and the Education Department followed that mandate. Campuses have a wide range of possibilities in what they can do to comply with the Higher Ed Act, and so there isn't a one-size-fits-all answer, and so what EDUCAUSE tried to do was select a number of campuses from around the country, large and small and state and private, and have them fill out templates to indicate how they are complying. And I asked two of those role models to come along to this session to tell you in person what they're doing and take some questions. So I'm going to spend a few minutes, just a few minutes, telling you about the general background of the Higher Ed Act. I suspect by now all of you know, but so at the risk of boring you, I'll give you this. Then we'll hear from Ken and Kent, and then I'm going to come back for a couple of minutes to talk about what you might be seeing in the future, because I've been hoping this for a number of months and failing, but I hope that this is the last time we have to do a session on complying with the Higher Ed Act of 2008. but we'll see. So I'll come back at the end. So this act was really signed in August of 2008, and to give you an idea of how long ago that was, it was President Bush who signed the Higher Ed Opportunity Act, which means that the drafting for this language, for the act, started 3 years ago, which is an eternity ago, and explains some of the myths and misunderstandings that I'm going to mention in another minute. So signed in August of 08, a few months after that, the Department of Education began a process known as negotiated rulemaking. And this is what happens whenever the Department of Education is mandated by Congress to do something. They have to write the rules and give the campuses at least a six-month warning for what those rules are going to be. So there's a period during which the rules were negotiated. Those were finalized the end of October. It was actually October 30th of 2009, and that's when the clock began. And the next possible time that enforcement could begin was July 1st of 2010. So those timelines are ensconced in Department of Education regulations, all of which makes one of many points here, and that is this is not copyright law. Right? The Higher Ed Act did not change copyright law. This is an education law. And what that means is that when you think about the penalties for not being in compliance with the Higher Ed Act, think about the penalties of not being in compliance with FERPA, because it's essentially in the same section of the law. And as you probably know, if you're not in compliance with FERPA, you can lose all federal funding that would come to your organization, to your institution, through the Department of Education. Now, it's also worth knowing that the number of times that an institution has lost funding because of violation of FERPA is exactly zero. And that's because the process that the Department of Education goes through when there is a violation of the Education Act is to notify the campus, try to get the campus to come into compliance, and only as a last resort would funding be withheld. Nonetheless, the possible penalties for not being in compliance with the Higher Ed Act are enormous, so it's worth being in compliance. And as of July 1st of 2010, all of our campuses should be in compliance. So, before Ken and Kent tell you how they are in compliance, I want to tell you the three elements of the Higher Ed Opportunity Act in this area that every campus must be in compliance with. So number one is you have to have and implement a written plan to effectively combat infringement on your networks. And there are a number of elements to that plan. You'll hear how Ken and Kent have complied with those elements, but the two I wanted to focus on, one of them is that your plan must include one or more technology-based deterrents. Now, the Congress in their deliberations and the Department of Education in their rulemaking recognized that there's a wide range of things that will be called technology-based deterrents. In fact, there are four that are called out in the regulations, and those four are bandwidth shaping. Now, that sounds like a technology-based deterrent. Traffic monitoring to identify the largest bandwidth users. That sounds like a technology-based deterrent. A vigorous program of accepting and responding to DMCA Act notices. Well, that may not sound to us techies like a technology-based deterrent, but by definition, in the regulations for complying with the Higher Ed Opportunity Act, if you are doing that, you are using a technology-based deterrent. The fourth one, and I listed these not in any random order, this is the order in which they are listed in the regulations, a variety of commercial products designed to reduce or block illegal file sharing, that's the one that a lot of people think is the definition of technology-based deterrent. But it isn't. It's one of four, and as far as the regulations are concerned, they are all equally in compliance. So if your plan includes one of those four things, your plan includes a technology-based deterrent. Another thing your plan has to do, there's a number of them, I'm just calling out two, as I said, is to be periodically reevaluated. Every now and then you have to take a look at the plan to see if it is continuing to effectively combat infringement on your network. But when you evaluate it, you will be using relevant assessment criteria. And you choose the assessment criteria by which you evaluate your plan, and I believe both Ken and Kent will tell us about the assessment criteria that their campuses have decided to use, so I won't belabor that point. The second of the three requirements is that you have to offer legal alternatives. Now, for a long time, when the bill was being drafted and looked at, the presumption was that that meant you have to enter some sort of site license to provide alternatives to everybody on campus. Not true. Offer alternatives was deemed by the Department of Education to mean provide a list of alternatives. Intriguingly enough, on the day that the negotiated rulemaking started, Ruckus went out of the business, and at that point there was no way that we could have site licensed. Well, that's okay. Congress couldn't have intended that every campus be required to site license content. If they did, there'd be a great gnashing of teeth from Silicon Valley where Steve Jobs would have said, wait a minute, you just undercut my entire business model. And so there's no way that Congress could have intended that. And then finally, you have to regularly inform your campus about a variety of copyright laws and your policies. And again, you will hear from Ken and Kent about how to do this. So just one more slide where I want to say, so from what you've just heard me say, if nothing else, take away the recognition, and these slides will be uploaded, that you are not required, it is okay to do any of these things, but it is not the case, mythology notwithstanding, it is not the case that the Higher Ed Opportunity Act requires you to count DMCA notices or reduce them or reduce infringement to zero or have less infringement every year or file your plan with the Department of Education. You just have to have it on your campus. It doesn't require you to detect. That word was scrapped along the way. You don't have to prevent. That word was scrapped along the way. You don't have to monitor. That word was scrapped along the way, and you don't have to license. So with that, we'll let Ken Pfluger tell you about Pomona.
Thanks, Steve. I suppose our approach could be best characterized by the minimalist approach. And perhaps that being able to take that approach is afforded to us in the fact that I would consider a very small institution. We have a little over 1,500 undergraduate students, 99.9% of whom live on campus. So, and we're part of what's called the Claremont University Consortium. Generally speaking, our campus culture is adverse to policy, so it's pretty difficult to get, they talk about approving a policy, and there's a joke, we don't even have a process for getting a policy approved. That's not quite the case, but it's almost the case. It's been traditionally, and it's now spelled out in a written policy that IT does not monitor the content of the network traffic on our campus. So we're not interested in the content of what people are sending around on the campus network. We're not there proactively looking at that. And I suppose if you were here last year at EDUCAUSE and heard Lawrence Lessig talk about copyright, we definitely resonate with what he was saying. We both recognize our responsibilities, but try to push the limit in inserting what rights we have under the copyright law. So that's kind of the context under which we're functioning. Because we're small, most things on our campus are handled in a personalized approach, so very much our approach is kind of a one-on-one kind of thing. One of the things that we thought about when we're looking at what we were going to do was to really try and incorporate our approach into existing processes. And so it was very important for us to collaborate with the Dean of Students Office in any sort of enforcement or any of those kinds of issues. This is not something, as I say there in the last point, that IT was not suddenly going to become the enforcer. That's not really a role we play on our campus. So we integrated it really with some existing policies and procedures on the student side of the house. The other thing we did is we did talk to our associated students about the policy and sort of got their sense of it. Obviously, they have a very much more liberal view of this than we do, but we at least wanted them to feel that they'd been consulted. So what do we do to comply? In terms of I'm just going to quickly run through the areas that Steve went down or talked about already. In terms of the annual disclosure to inform students, we simply have a joint letter that goes from myself and the Dean of Students to every year to the students. We've been doing it at the start of the academic year, and this year we're going to actually do it at the beginning of each semester. So there's a more sort of increased frequency. We now have published policies and procedures that are part of the student handbook. We revised slightly our acceptable use policy to sort of highlight the whole issue of copyright and peer-to-peer file sharing. And then we've actually created a quick link to highlight it on our ITS website for students, so it's very easy for them to find this information. I should mention the letter that goes out is actually an email that's sent to the students, and it has links to all the various pieces of information, just trying to increase the likelihood that they might go and look at it. In terms of the things that we're doing relative to bandwidth issues, we actually have a couple of levels of bandwidth shaping. There are some things that take place on the consortium level because we share internet connections with the other six schools in the consortium. And then we have some things that we're doing internally. We have some automatically generated reports, alerts that go to IT staff when what we've defined as excessive bandwidth usage happens. And then we have a set of clearly articulated policies and procedures that I sat down and worked out with the Dean of Students on in terms of what we do when somebody is indeed engaged in excessive bandwidth usage. The same process and procedures apply to DMCA notices and how we deal with those as well. We don't really have a huge, I think because we've advertised this a lot, we don't have a lot of cases of infraction, and so it's pretty easy for us to deal with the students that are engaged in this kind of activity on a one-on-one basis. Having workshops or something, we just wouldn't really have much attendance at anything like that. In terms of legal alternatives, we don't really, in terms of the institutional culture, pay for various things. We don't provide our students with cable TV in the dorms, for example, and so we certainly weren't going to sign a contract to provide any kind of content in terms of songs or videos or anything like that. So we simply took the route of providing a list that we point to on the website, and we attempt to sort of maintain that, updating it with some regularity. In terms of the review procedure, we have a written sort of policy and procedures in place that the review happens annually, usually in June, at the end of June. And that review is really taking an analysis of sort of the current year's data and comparing it as we gather and collect data over the years in terms of the number of cases that we have of excessive bandwidth usage, as well as looking at the number of DMCA notices that we're getting, and using just those two stats to gauge whether we're being successful in what we're doing. And so far, really, there hasn't been much change in either of those stats, and so we feel like what we're doing is more than adequate to stay in compliance with the law.
Well, things never quite work the way you expect. Okay, well, so I am not going to be talking about our general DMCA approach to illegal file sharing. You can actually go read about that. That site, p2p.ucla.edu, has tons and tons of our information, including a lot of documentation about our overall approach, which is a student life approach, really similar, I guess, to what Ken was talking about, shared with our Dean of Students office and our student and campus life area. What I am going to be talking, actually, okay, so this was a slide I inserted from a slide I took from a pre-conference seminar yesterday. It's entirely gratuitous, talking about UCLA, but really to emphasize that we are a little bit different in size and character than than Pomona College that Ken comes from. It's also worth keeping in mind that UCLA is just one of the 10 campuses of the UC University system. So it's pretty big. We actually have guidelines that are required across the system, so there is some uniformity, but each of the campuses actually has a fair amount of leeway in terms of the specifics of how we address the HEOA. So these are, Steve actually characterized the requirements as sort of three general categories. I'm characterizing them sort of in five areas that we felt operationally we had to address. And so they're the technology-based deterrence, the education and awareness kinds of things, legal alternatives, the procedures for dealing with unauthorized distribution of copyright, and your periodic plan and assessment. And I'm going to focus on three of those because I think these are the three which are a little bit unique to UCLA. So let me start with the community education and annual disclosure to students. We do a lot of different things. Again, if you look at the document at p2p.ucla.edu, we do things in, for orientation, for parents' orientation, because, of course, they're the people who end up paying if there were fines when there used to be fines when the RIA were suing students. Informational websites, lots of workshops, promotional activities of all sorts, an annual letter that comes from our Dean of Students and our CIO, and of course a bunch of policies. I will say, and I can say this since the pre-conference seminar that I was co-teaching yesterday afternoon was about creating IT policy programs and enhancing them, we are not policy light at the University of California. In fact, one of the attendees in yesterday's class said, maybe you should call yourselves polyunsaturated, or polysaturated as opposed to policy light. The one thing, though, that I think that is really interesting here at UCLA is these information workshops. We started observing a couple of years ago that we were getting people who were getting second claims of infringements. So not first-time recipients of DMCA claims, but second-time recipients, and that percentage was going up. So our assistant dean of students who adjudicates these kinds of things created these information workshops. He teaches them 9 to 10 times a quarter. This is a very human-intensive kind of thing. And they're for people who receive a first claim of copyright infringement. Again, not a guarantee that they actually infringe copyright, just that they received a claim. And he goes through with them, you know, what this is about, some general context, answers questions, is really interactive with them, and basically tells them, you know, this is not something you want to do again in case you did it the first time and this was, you know, not a bogus claim. Spends a lot of time with them. They're actually really useful. So we had, as I say, we were seeing a general about 9 to 10% recidivism rate, people who received the second claim of copyright infringement. And it crept up to about 13%, which is when he went and put this into place. And after he started doing this for about not quite a year, our recidivism rate dropped to close to zero. Not quite zero. We had a couple of really recalcitrant students who didn't repent. But and he was very annoyed about those because it, you know, ruined that perfect 0% recidivism rate. But nevertheless, it's been very effective. It is, on the other hand, extremely time intensive. And this recent spike of RIAA claims has just about killed him trying to address all of the people who have been caught in this latest net. So these workshops, as I say, are mandatory for first-time recipients, not necessarily for anyone else, but other people have attended just because they're interested. Really very effective if you can afford the time. The second area I'd like to talk about is the periodic review of our plan and the assessment piece. As I said, we've really been using recidivism as our sort of our base metric for how well we're doing overall in terms of our anti-infringement program. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, when someone receives a second claim of copyright infringement. I think Steve, amongst others, will tell you that, you know, just pure counts of DMCA claims that you receive is probably more or less meaningless as any metric of, you know, how well you're doing or how poorly you're doing. But we feel like if you receive one claim, that may be meaningless. If you receive a second claim, you know, what was it about the first time when we talked to you at one of these workshops that you didn't understand this is a bad thing to do? You know, don't do this again. So we feel like if you receive a second one, clearly you didn't connect the two dots, and somehow either we failed or they failed. We are continually incrementally tweaking our programs. We have so many pieces to our anti-infringement program from the student affairs side, from the IT side, and also from our legal side that, I mean, there really is each area of the campus is always looking at what it can do better. So we're not actually saying we're going to do a formal assessment at any given time because we are doing this all the time. The other thing that we think will strengthen our argument, even though we're not giving a specific time frame in which we're going to do these assessments, is this joint study that we did with the MPAA back in 2008. we had our management school team of six really unbelievably wonderful MBA students actually do this study about student beliefs and attitudes on illegal file sharing, on digital entertainment, and come back to us with recommendations both to the university side about how we could do better and also to the entertainment industry about new business models for providing digital entertainment. It was really an amazing report, and our greatest disappointment was that because of some political stuff, we were never able to share that report. Nevertheless, the information in that report has guided UCLA and what it's been doing for the last 2 years and continues to guide us, and we are planning, in fact, we just started this last couple of weeks with a new team of six MBA students who's going to be essentially repeating that study in terms of a longitudinal from a longitudinal perspective, so we will have two data points, but also starting to answer some questions, more questions about how much more effective we can be, how have things changed, and how can we adjust what we're doing based on how incredibly different the world is now than it was just 2 years ago. So the last thing is about legal alternatives. We are providing the same list as many other people, pointing to places like Illinois State's Bird Tracks and, of course, the EDUCAUSE list. But we are also partnering with a company called Clicker. And this is you can think of it as a sort of a Google for video or television entertainment or video entertainment, something like that. Or like a Hulu, except that Clicker doesn't actually own any of the content. It just indexes it and catalogs it. So we've been partnering with them to produce UCLA on Clicker. What our content is, we provide the UCLA content, so when you do searches, you also get UCLA content, the stuff we want to advertise, together with all the stuff that's available on the net more generally. And so we're actually trying to promote UCLA content at the same time as making it really easy for students to find legal sources of television shows and movies and what have you. This is a two-year pilot. It started back in February. I still can't say whether or not this is going to be successful. We think it is successful, but I think we'll have much more data starting or after this academic year. So check back in a year, assuming we actually have to have another session on the HEOA. I think the last thought I'd like to leave you with is that most of what we do in terms of our anti-infringement activities is sort of preventative, if you will. It tries to make it difficult to do the wrong thing. The UCLA and Clicker thing is particularly attractive to us because it tries to make it easy to do the right thing. And there's a real difference in approach there, and we're trying to do sort of both at the same time, recognizing you can't just depend on the one, but we would prefer not to just be on the negative side as well. So I think that's my piece.
Okay, so very quickly, since the abstract said we would do some speculation about where this is going, I want to say a few words about what's going on inside the Beltway about combating infringement on the Internet in general. There's a new player in town. Her name is Victoria Espinel. She is the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator, a new position, and she operates out of the White House. And I've got to tell you, you drop a White House official into a universe where there were a whole bunch of departments, whether it was the Justice Department or the Commerce Department or any other compliance office, who thought that they owned part of an area and say there's now a person in the White House that's supposed to coordinate that stuff. Suddenly everybody in all of those other departments suddenly gets very busy showing that they've been active in that area all along. And gee, why did you have to hire somebody into the White House to do this? Nonetheless, that person is in the White House because Congress passed a law again back in the Bush administration. But it was only President Obama that filled the position. And Victoria Espinel has been out there really stirring up the waters, and there's a lot more activity in D.C. Looking at copyright issues on the Internet than there was a year ago. There's a number of notices of inquiry out there. EDUCAUSE will be responding to some of them. None of them directly ask about higher ed, but some of them have questions that are relevant to higher ed. So watch for new news about your IPEC. Second, the focus is moving. There was a colloquium about this on July 1st, and mainly the MPA, but the RIA bought into this as well. And they essentially implied, they may not have said it in so many words, that P2P is not their biggest concern anymore, which is not to diminish the concern that we all have about the recent spike in DMCA notices caused by P2P on our campuses. But what you're hearing about are these slick, professional-looking, legitimate-looking websites where you or your users or your parents or your kids can go and find that they will happily sell you movies. They'll happily download movies to you. These look professional. They'll charge you. They're not doing it for free. They're out there to make money. They even have ads on these websites. And I've seen examples of these websites where some of the ads are for places like Netflix. But what's interesting is these websites aren't paying royalties to anyone. They're totally pirate. They're all operated offshore, except you have no way of knowing that's what's going on. And this is the abuse that the content industry is beginning to worry about more and more. And so back on June 30th, there was a lot of press about an FBI operation that seized the DNS names of a number of these sites. It was called Operation In Our Sites. Ha ha, isn't that a cute pun? And recognize it, well, you know, sort of not taking the hint that gee, if the FBI could do that with the existing law, a couple of weeks ago, Senator Leahy introduced into the Judiciary Committee something called COICA, the Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeiting Act, Senate Bill 3804, which would give the Attorney General more authority than he currently has to declare websites to be of this category, saying this website is primarily dedicated to infringement, and give the Attorney General the right to go to the registrar or registry for that website and require that registrar or registry take that domain name away. Well, when you look at these laws carefully, you discover that the people who wrote them clearly don't understand the Internet very well. So you may have figured out, just by hearing me say this, that, gee, what if the registrar or registry happens not to be under the control of the Attorney General, like all of the ones that aren't in the United States? Or what if the website, rather than having a name like foo.com, or more likely foo.tv, because that's not in the United States, where you can say, yes, registrar for .tv, take away the name foo.tv. What if it's got a name like a.b.c.d.tv? What registrar do you go to? Well, they didn't quite figure that out. More concern to us is, what if it's got a name like a.b.c.d.edu? And there's where the rub is. And so there's some issues about what's involved in taking the domain name away, what that might mean. But there's also provisions in the Act that would give the Attorney General the right, without going to court, to create a list of sites that the Attorney General has just unilaterally deemed to be infringing. Not that anybody's supposed to do anything about that list. There's just that list there, and on and on. So we and a number of other public interest groups are working with members of Congress to see if we can either get them to recognize that this bill is unnecessary, would do more harm than good, but at the very least get it rewritten in a way that might make some technological sense. Finally, the thing to watch for is you know, however much we may say negative things about the DMCA and negative things about getting DMCA notices, the beauty of the DMCA is that it gives ISPs, campus ISPs and commercial ISPs, a safe harbor so that if an infringement claim comes along, if the ISP does something reasonable, the ISP cannot be sued. And what the flip side of that coin means, what the flip side of that coin does is it removes any proactive responsibility from the ISPs. It means that none of our campuses, nor Time Warner, nor Comcast, or anyone, has the responsibility to proactively monitor all of the stuff that is taking place over their network. It means that YouTube does not have to proactively monitor everything that gets uploaded to YouTube. What it means is that a rights holder can file a claim, and on the basis of that claim, require internet service providers to do something. Congress and the regulatory agencies and the content owners are getting the idea that's not good enough, and they'd sort of like to go back to the way things would have been without the DMCA, and that is that unless internet service providers are proactive in keeping bad stuff off of their network, then they would be potentially liable And watch for legislation coming out along those lines. Various countries in Europe are playing with that idea. The Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA, is playing with things like that. So those are the things to watch for in the future. So with that, we'll open it up for questions, but I'm gonna play a bit of EDUCAUSE live game here, and I'm gonna ask a couple of questions first while you think about questions yourself. We have about 13 minutes, if my watch is reasonably correct. So what I want to know from Kent and Ken, two things. Number one, how much did you have to change your existing policies with respect to infringement, with respect to acceptable use, in order to do what you felt was necessary to come into compliance with the HEOA? And then, and I'll get that answer from both of you, but then I want you to tell me how you assess, how effective do you think you've been? Now, presumably you've only had this in place for a few months, but based on those few months, how effectively do you think you're operating? So Ken, how much did you have to change to come into compliance?
Actually, we really had to change very little. More of what we did was actually to document and put in writing what we were already doing, which was sort of making just more formal exactly what we most, for the most part, had been doing. In terms of the success, certainly in the criteria that we've used, and we've been kind of monitoring this, so we do have some benchmark data, there really hasn't been much change in terms of either the repeat rate on DMCA notices that any individual student gives, or in terms of the number of excessive bandwidth usage cases that we have per year. So we sort of feel that what we're doing is working.
Kent?
Yeah, actually, I think it's probably more or less the same for us as well. In we've been doing this for a number of years now, and it was, I wouldn't call it just a documentation exercise. It was really an opportunity to take a look at what we were doing and making sure that it did actually make sense. Probably the largest piece of work was literally doing the analysis of the legislation and the regulatory requirements with a lot of, you know, EDUCAUSE's help and our convener here, Steve from University of UC Irvine, but to make sure that we understood exactly what was really necessary and mapping that to what we were doing.
So we've got about 10 minutes. Questions, comments? Yes. So for those who may not have been able to hear that, the question essentially is, how do you deal with infringement by staff, and how do you deal with infringement by guest users of the network? Kent?
The staff, I would say, is I agree. I mean, it's sort of handled the way any other kind of misconduct is handled by staff. In terms of the guest services, you know, we, like Ken just said, I mean, we don't monitor what happens. We don't block, mainly on academic for academic freedom purposes, but that's also the culture of the university. On the other hand, for places like during the summer, in our residence halls, where it's almost entirely conference people, for example, we do just block P2P because we, you know, we're not there as a general ISP, and don't feel, I mean, the burden is just, it doesn't make sense. Yeah, because our students and our faculty are not involved.
Yeah, we take essentially that same approach, so that there's very, very minimal kinds of things that guests could do. I think in terms of groups that have risen to the top, rather more so than employees, the faculty who have been doing illegal things has been more sensitive to deal with. But we've worked through the Dean of Faculty's office there, and that's really been her issue to deal with.
I'll just add one last thing about our guest services kinds of networks. It is pretty constrained, but we do allow people to VPN out essentially to their institution, and then do whatever the heck they want. But of course, if they do something illegal, then it's an IP address associated with their institution, not ours. Yeah.
Something worth noting, by the way, in that first category, employees, the safe harbor idea, right? That means that you don't have to proactively try to prevent problems, but rather respond to notices. That's for third party content. Okay? When it's one of your employees that are infringing, it's you who's infringing. Yep. It's the institution exactly. That's infringing. And therefore, the copyright violation claim wouldn't be vicarious or indirect infringement. It would be the university of whoever is infringing. And that's something that you really want to pay attention to. Totally apart. That's not an HEOA Act issue. That's plain old avoid liability for copyright infringement.
tagging or at least identifying excessive bandwidth users. What particular technologies you are using for that?
So the question is, to the extent that you're identifying excessive bandwidth users, how are you doing that?
We just do an analysis of NetFlow data out of our Cisco switches, and we're using a program called Intermapper to do that. So it's something we've had in place for a number of years, so it wasn't anything new. Fairly simple.
I don't know. Showing that I've more or less become a paper pusher, I guess. I have no idea.
Well, are you even doing that? Are you identifying excessive bandwidth users? Because I'm not
yes.
sure that was in your list.
Mainly, for making sure the network is okay, not for this purpose. Only for receipts of DMCA claims.
So the question is, are you automating the identification of repeat infringers?
Right. We're not looking ourselves for people who are infringing. We're depending on receipt of DMCA claims by the rights holders.
But while you've got the microphone, do you want to say a word about ACNS?
ACNS is the automated copyright notice system, something I can never remember what it is.
Content
notification system. And it's really a framework for being able to automatically route when you receive a DMCA claim from the outside to route it to the right place pretty quickly and pretty efficiently. We've been using that for a number of years now with some homegrown technology by and large to make it as simple as possible to get the claim, as soon as the claim comes in, to get it to the person to the right place as quickly as possible, and also just to relieve the administrative burden of having to do that manually, because we put so much of the human effort into things like those workshops that I was talking about.
But from your answer then, I take it that ACNS doesn't identify repeat infringers, it doesn't sort of maintain the data at that level of accuracy or detail?
I'm just trying to remember. I don't know. I can't remember.
But anyway, if you're interested in automating your process in some way, Kent's the guy to talk to.
In fact, I think it's just movielabs.com/ACNS and caps, a capital A-C-N-S.
Do you want to repeat infringers?
We actually automatically route when we get DMCA notices into our service desk tracking system, so it creates a ticket, and they're kept in their own workspace, and it's our service desk staff, according to our procedures, who first deal with them. So, and it makes it fairly easy, since they're in there, to look for repeat names. I mean, it's probably easier. Again, we're a small campus, so... So it's hard for somebody to hide.
Stephen.
Two comments. One, the ACNS isn't going to help you identify the individual unless the individual is always using the same IP address. It doesn't contain the name of the individual. It simply contains the technical information. And for that, what Ken suggests is exactly right. If your student affairs or whoever is handling these things doesn't just handle them but keeps track of, have I seen this student before, whether it be for drunkenness or listening to rowdy music, they'll pick it up that way. And that's where the student conduct office really, in our case, helps us. The other
good point.
Thing I think is very valuable that Ken just sort of slipped by there is that this is part of effective network management. In many cases, an overrun on download may be an indication, or even worse, upload, of a security concern. And so you want to track that if for just that reason, even if you don't care how much it costs you in terms of whatever. And I think that one of the things that we in the group that Kent talked about as being within the University of California that was convened by UC Office of the President so that we could share this experience stressed is that we do not monitor network content, but we do monitor network traffic as part of watching out for a whole range of things, not the least of which is network security.
Other comments, questions? Sir. What about the notices that don't have the XML for ACNS?
Are you getting any of those?
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know who.
Pay artists.
Oh. But doesn't it, even the ones that aren't properly formatted still have an IP, have to have at least an IP address and a time and date stamp? Right, right. Yeah, in that case, it may not help you as much.
Other comments, questions? Sir?
Can you said you force first offenders to go to the workshop. How do you force them? You turn off their network connection until they do? What's the motivation?
Yes, actually, I think it's even more than that. They get a notice from the Dean of Students' office, and that notice is in their academic record as well, saying something has happened. I don't know that it's a full hold on their academic record, which means they can't do various things, but there's definitely incentive there. I couldn't tell you exactly what. I could find out for you if you want.
Is there anybody who is having trouble on their campuses figuring out how to comply? Is this a big issue for anyone? You don't necessarily have to identify what campus you're from. This is sort of a hard thing to ask. But I could of course put it this way. Does anybody know of a campus that? I have a friend at a campus that hasn't come into compliance and either doesn't think it's important or doesn't care, or somebody who has come into compliance and found it really difficult, found it a real challenge. You've succeeded, you're in compliance, you're not worried about violating any law, but you really found it difficult and you have some lessons to confer on the rest of us that might be helpful. Yes. You're the only hand. I heard a voice, but I didn't see a hand. Good. Well, interesting to hear. Are there other people whose student life folks are in similar position? Capital punishment on first offense? Okay. Oh, you are.
It's not capital punishment. It's a matter of we suspend network access until the situation can be cleared. Now, that may be considered capital punishment, but it's not a matter of please come in. Network access via that mechanism is suspended.
We're pretty much out of time. Let me do a quick poll. Who figures that this is the last time that we ever have to have a session talking about the peer-to-peer provisions of the Higher Ed Act of 2008? Oh, dear. So we need to do this again next year?
Can we preface it with it not necessarily about the Higher Ed Act, but something else involving peer-to-peer next year?
Is that what's behind the lack of hands being raised? Tell your friend to go to the EDUGOES webpage.
I would also like to say if your friend only got three notices, I would gladly trade places with him.
Well, maybe see you again next year, maybe not. Thanks a lot for coming.